All right, let's take a look at some of the purposes of religion in ancient times. There are, as far as I can tell, five major dynamics that make paganism work. One, as we've talked about, is the endemic instinct of worship. God has put that inside of man. He has made man for himself, and man cannot escape from that. He is connected to God. If you read Psalm chapter 2, you see man in his rebellion talking about breaking the threefold cord that connects him to God. And so man recognizes that he is very much tied to God and is continually in his rebellion against God, trying to break loose of that bond. In sin, man must worship. As we've said, he must worship. He doesn't necessarily have to worship God because his sin is self-oriented. That's the nature of sin. Sin is self-oriented. It has a tendency to want to put the self at the center all the time. In our sanctified Christian life, one of the great quests of our life is to try to get out of the center and let God be at the center where he truly is. But we, as sinners, make ourselves out to be little gods, and as little gods, we will grow and grow in our own minds into bigger and bigger gods. So that worship tends to be self-centered. We'll do that either directly or we'll do it, as we would say, sacerdotally. Either I'm going to worship myself or I'm going to worship someone as my representative. All right? And that representative is always going to be, at one level or another, a representative of myself, some extension of myself, someone that I can fantasize about. I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about the nature of imagination, but we'll get into that in a little bit. Another dynamic is an ideological dynamic. And we've talked about that a great deal. I mean, we could do that a lot more. And I posted Romans 1 up here at the beginning of this section because if you read Romans 1, it's going to give you a breakdown of how paganism rises up in human heart. It's a great passage on the psychology of mythology. It very much shows how the corrupting nature of sin inside of us brings us to that place where we'll go very low in our reverence. You know, religion, let's think of it in terms of worship or reverence. Religion is either going to lift us up or it's going to tear us down. There's no in-between ground there. The only way that religion is going to lift us up is if we are worshiping as high a God as we possibly can. And since there's only one God, that's going to be only one person, and that's going to be the true Creator and Sovereign God of the Scriptures. When we worship Him, we are lifted up. If we don't worship Him, we can do nothing but grind ourselves into the earth. Because you don't revere something that is below you. How can you do that? All right? Try revering your dog. All right? If you get down and start worshiping your dog, what do you do to yourself? You become less than your dog. And any religion that worships anything less than God is a lowering of man. It is a desecration of man. All right? So, as hard as we may try to find gods, our gods are always lesser. And therefore, they're always casting us down all the time. Only the true God can lift us up as we humble ourselves before Him and worship Him. The humility before God is exalting to us. Isn't that interesting? And how is it so? Because He is so high that our humiliation before Him, our servitude before Him, our glorification of Him raises us up. It raises us up. Without which we can do nothing but grovel in the dirt our whole lives long. All right? So religion serves either as an escape from reality. We saw where Adam and Eve have tried to run away. Man's been trying to run away ever since. Mythography is that. It's an escape. It's an escape out of the real world around us and into the world of the mind, into the world of the imagination. The emphasis is on altered states, not on actual reality. So what we're basically doing is trying to suspend ourselves in a stasis so that we can reduce ourselves completely to I am. And everything else around us is nothing more than our illusion. You know, that is a feature of our self-delusion is that once we become the only thing there is, then what's everything else? Our dream, our delusion. Krishna on a lotus blossom, dreaming all of reality. And each one of us is our own Krishna, all right? And we're dreaming each other. What does that do to our relationships with one another? It puts everybody in infinite servitude to us because we're the only one who really exists. Guilt and rebellion. In all of the pagan religions, there is the abomination, all right? The taboo, the thing you don't do. And then there's always that festival at one time of the year when you do the taboo. You are to do the taboo. You are to enter into the abomination. And the worse the abomination is, and they got really bad, the more sacrifice, atonement, expiation was needed when it was over with. So the worse you get, the more you sacrifice. And the more you sacrifice, the worse you get. And the worse you get, the more you sacrifice. It's a loop. It keeps going on. And the sacrifices become a part of the abominations because they get worse and worse and worse and worse and more and more and more prolific. And so that's a dynamic. These dynamics go out of control. Well, we talked about the familiar, the ancestor, the familial or the ancestor worship that developed, the deification of ancestors, staffs, totems, statues for remembrance. The political aspects, the political dynamic, the city-state development, which we're going to talk about more later as we begin to look at the transition, the astronomical and the cosmological aspects of religion, the celestial wheel and the terrestrial wheel, the relationship between those two, which I will explain in the next one, the accidental wheel or the infernal wheel as well, the mechanics of statist paganism, all right? And then there are the environmental ideas. There are local cataclysms. There are universal cataclysms, climatic changes, migration. There are the phenomena of earth and sky, war, all kinds of things that begin to be brought into the religious system on the local level, all right? There are two directions that paganism moves in. There is that attempted conformity to the pristine state of religion, trying to hold as close to the old patriarchal as possible. The preservation of revelations and the righteous rule. We talked about this because it's in it is more in Mesopotamian Egypt than it is elsewhere. The twisting of truth in these, using ritual as a cache for revelation. If you get into the rituals of a lot of the high pagan religions, you'll see truth being embedded in it in a twisted sort of way. The dissection of the gods behind the gods, taking the gods apart and studying them, as we saw with the Egyptians. Deifying the attributes of them and so forth. And then there is a rebellion against the pristine state that always takes place after a while. Man can't tolerate the pristine state of religion. All right, he's got to do something about it. God's always wise. Now, let's make sure that we track this. Because as this is developing, it's developing through the time of the patriarchs, through the time of the sojourn, while the children of Israel are in Egypt. By the time the children of Israel are in Egypt, we're into the 11th, 12th, 13th dynasties of Egypt. Egypt now has passed on from those early days when it was protecting the religion, and it now begins to shift into that period of time in its history where it begins to resist the religion. One of the reasons why the Hebrews had to die was because they represented the old system within Egypt, and Egypt was going through a transition at that very time into a different kind of paganism. They were turning away from the old principles of protecting God's attributes, and now they were beginning to reinvent their religion. And here we have the Israelites who were lodged there with this extremely pure religion among them that is challenging them and making them want to go back. You remember that there was a Pharaoh who rose up who did not know Joseph? That period was the period between the 11th and the 12th dynasties. The Pharaoh who knew Joseph was one of the last pharaohs of the 11th dynasty, and his name was Amenemhat III. Amenemhat III knew Joseph. I think we know that pretty well, not only by revised chronology, but also because his reign is the reign of the lean and the fat and the lean years. The great famine took place in his time. And the reason why we know that, by the way, is in case you want to know, is because there are pylons on the Nile River. And those pylons mark the high water mark of the Nile. And next to the marks of the high water mark is the cartouche of the king. All right? And these 11th dynasty pylons were very carefully monitored because they were having Nile problems during that time. It's kind of interesting, but the Egyptians at that point began to name their children Sobek. And Sobek means the crocodile god, who is the Nile god. And so you're going to hear even of pharaohs, even into the 12th dynasty, Sobekhotep. These are concerns about the conditions of the Nile that are in those days. The 11th dynasty pharaohs are pictured in the statues with very worried looks on their face. You know how happy... You know, you've always got these little impish, happy Egyptian kings, you know, and they got the little grin on their face and everything like that. Not these guys. They all had frowns on their face. Now, some people originally thought that they had the frowns because they were mean kings. The truth is, they weren't. They were actually very good kings. They were provincial kings. They cared very much about their people. And but the reason why you see this among these 11th dynasty kings is because they've been having some real terrible Nile problems leading up to this point. The major problem that they had with the Nile was not that it was not coming up to level. It's because it was going way above level. All right? It was flooding. And the famine, the nature of the Egyptian famine, was that because it was flooding, it wasn't clearing the water out in time to lay down the crop. And that wasted the entire year's crop. Totally wasted. You could not plant after that period, after it had passed that season. If that water didn't get back into the river in time, you didn't have a crop that year. All right. So it wasn't a too little water problem. It was a too much water problem. And the Nile had been coming just slightly above level for years before Joseph came along. In the reign of Amenhotep III, he hired a vizier by the name of Anki. All you got to do is take a look at the life of Anki, and you'll find out that man was Joseph. And there are statues of him, and there's actually a statue of his father, Jacob, and that were recorded there. And this was a time of great care. And it was the 11th dynasty period. This was the time of Joseph. The 12th dynasty comes along shortly after that, during the time that of the Israelite sojourn in Egypt. And during the changeover into the 12th dynasty come different ideas about administration from a whole different family of rulers, those who did not know Joseph. And that's when the time of the enslavement of the Israelites takes place. And it was during the time of these pharaohs that the Apiru were made into slaves. The Apiru, that is the Egyptian word for Hebrews, all right? And they were made into slaves. Who's the... I'm on it. I might as well go ahead and finish it out, all right? Who was Moses' stepfather? His name was Khneferes Hobekhetep IV. That was his stepfather. About 12 or 13 pharaohs later is the pharaoh of the Exodus. These pharaohs only lived to be between 20 and 40 years old. So there were many pharaohs before, and you know, 80 years goes by between the time of Moses' birth and the time of the Exodus. And in that 80 years, about 12 or 13 pharaohs came and went. So that by the time you get to the Exodus pharaoh, whose name is Dudamos, by the way, it's not Ramses. Ramses is they're 300 years off with Ramses. He doesn't come about until the time of Jeroboam. All right, his name is Shishak in the Bible, but Dudamos is the last pharaoh in the 13th dynasty, and he is a desecrated pharaoh. All right, the pharaohs in the 14th dynasty, 15th, 16th dynasty, they desecrated him, and the reason for doing so is because he brought the wrath of God upon Egypt, they said, and brought about the destruction of Egypt. And so he's our Exodus pharaoh. All right. Great book on that by David Roll, Pharaohs and Kings. Highly recommend that one to you if you're into that sort of thing. I think it may be in the bibliography. Maybe, maybe not. I don't remember. All right. And you know, any resource you want on some of the things that we talked about, feel free to ask. What's the purpose of religion? That's what I want to wrap up this section with. What is the purpose of religion to the pagans of that time? You know, and let's make sure that we deconstruct ideas about that all right, well, let me just put it this way. Talk to an agnostic, all right? The agnostic is going to throw all religion in one bucket, and he's going to call it control. That's what he's going to call it. That's the only reason for religion in the world, control. You know, a bunch of elite people make up a whole lot of stories about gods and stuff to scare people to death so that they can keep them under control, all right? That is the dumbest thing. Just think about it. I mean, just spend a little time thinking about it. You are going to control everybody for over 2,000 years with these kind of lies and these kind of made up things. Now that assumes right off the bat that the whole world was under the same system. And the whole world wasn't under the same system. It was under a whole lot of countervailing systems. I mean, you had Egypt. You had Mesopotamia. You had the Chinese. You had the Mediterranean. You had all of these, you know, the Mesopotamians. You had the Indus Valley Indians, all of these kind of things. They're all doing that, and it's all working. I mean, I don't give a whole lot of credit to man, but I give a little bit more than that. How long do you fool people with stupid lies? If all religion was in those days was control, then, you know, there's not a whole lot of hope for the human race. I mean, I don't know how to put it, but it's just crazy, you know. Yeah, you can fool a lot of people with a lie for a while, but you can't do it that long and do it with the same thing over and over again. Or if you can, then I have to ask the atheist or the agnostic or whatever, I have to ask them, how do you know that everything you're thinking isn't under somebody's control now? I mean, if we're all that dumb, you know, at the most basic level, and I'm not a humanist or anything, don't get me wrong, but the person who says that usually at some level thinks he's superior to everybody who ever lived in the world. All right. Yes, you can fool people. Yes, you can control them by deception. You certainly can. But the idea of universal control for that long a period of time, coming out of a conspiracy of priesthood, that doesn't even fit the historical record at all. Priesthoods were not always in control of everything. There was always constant tension between priesthood and kingship. And so, as we see with Nebuchadnezzar and his Chaldeans, right? You know, and who was in control of that situation? You know, the deceivers? No, the man of power. He was the one who was in control of it. What has religion been there for? It's got to be something that everybody agrees to. It fits into in some way in the human psyche and in the human soul of the unregenerate person that everybody agrees this is a good thing, we want it, we need to keep it. All right? It helps to synthesize things. It helps us to understand things within certain tight spheres, but it does help us to understand things better. It helps us to syncretize things. It helps us to give explanations that we can accept for contradictory and countervailing forces. It also helps to preserve things that need to be preserved. You know, whether or not you're going to preserve the religion of God Almighty the Creator, or you're going to go to war against Him and against everything about Him, you've got to be able to pass this on from generation to generation to generation. Because this is a war of mankind against God, and it's not going to end in your generation. So you've got to be sure and pass the war on to the next generation. And you're going to do that through mythology, through religious ritual that conditions the mind for these purposes. You know, a lot of rituals in a lot of religions are there for mental and psychological conditioning, especially those that take place in the rite of passage into adulthood. Any kind of rituals that take place at that time usually are designed to set a mindset in that person as they pass into adulthood. And, of course, the only way that the pagan can do that is to, you know, terrify somebody so badly that it causes certain degrees of trauma and so forth. But if everybody has the same trauma and everybody has the same psychosis or neurosis, then basically you have a certain degree of normalization in society. Everybody's nuts, okay? So, you know, primitive societies are very good at this. You know, they go and steal all the boys away at the age of 7, take them off to some place and scare them to pieces for a long period of time until they're gibbering idiots. And by the time the whole thing is over with, they have totally conditioned them into the mindset they want them to be. Now think about this for the adults who did that. They're nuts too, because they had that done to them. And so what you wind up with is a conditioned society that is generation after generation built upon the religious system, the ritual practices and so forth of people who are probably just not right in the head. Okay? And yet they're all alike. And the likeness of the whole thing gives them a certain degree of stability. All right? But it also caused them to go into a psychological curve downward from generation to generation, which gets worse and worse and worse, into what we call primitivity. And I don't think that's a very good term, because the word primate seems to be in there, and that's an evolutionary term, but you get what I mean. Savagery. All right? Savagery is not the rising up out of the animal state. Savagery is the going down from the civilized state. All right? Man doesn't go up. He goes down. That's his direction of motion at all times. Religion reflects that. Religion brings it into a certain degree of stability. Now, when I say religion, I mean religion in the hands of sinful men. What man's purpose of religion is when he is the maker of religion. I'm certainly not talking about the religion of Christianity. Because I hope you understand, and I hope that this is getting even more clear to you, and we'll talk about this too as we look at the Bible versus these things, how contradictory this religion we have is to all of this. You know, it isn't, you know, and if we don't get anything else out of that, I think we'll get this. It is man could not have constructed the Christian religion, because his wiring just didn't run in that direction. Because the Christian religion is based on what? Self-sacrifice. And that goes completely antithetical to anything that man believes in. All of his religion has to at least attempt to exalt him, or to bring God down, even if it doesn't exalt him itself. There's one other thing that I want to talk about, and that is another of the purposes of heathen religion. Heathen religion is to do two things, and this is a dualism. It's to do two things. It is to promote and to attempt to annihilate chaos. To promote and to attempt to annihilate chaos. Now, I say that because man is, he's schizo in this one area right here. He loves chaos, but he hates chaos. All right? And I think this may be where the real battle between what God made us to be and what sin made us to be it really comes forward, is in this thing itself. Let's talk about the concept of chaos for just a minute. Because the concept of chaos is important. It's very important. And the reason why it's important is because, first of all, it's mentioned in Scripture. Or it is thought to be mentioned in Scripture. There's two Hebrew terms in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, called Tohu and Bohu. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. Tohu and Bohu. All right. I have heard that called chaos. All right. But that's not a good translation. In the beginning, there was chaos. That's not a good translation. All right. In the beginning, and I think that the King James translation is the best one. In the beginning, the earth was without form. It was formless. And it was empty. Formless and empty. Now, if you get that in your mind, then it doesn't look evil. What does it look like? Incomplete. Okay? God presents incompletions throughout creation, in order to fill those incompletions so that we can wonder at His work. So He'll show us a void and then fill it in. He does it with man. He creates man on the sixth day and then says, it is not good that man should be alone. Well, did God make a mistake? Whoa, I forgot. I forgot to do that. You know, no, God didn't make any mistakes at all. He does that and then shows us man alone. And He said, this is not a good thing. And then He creates woman. Solves the problem. He already knew He was going to do that. But he does it to arrest our attention so that we can see there's something very significant about the plurality of the human race. All right? There's got to be more than one. One is not enough. And he does that here. He shows us the emptiness of everything. He says, all substance is made. There it is right there, but it's not doing anything. It's just sitting there. Sitting there latent, doing nothing. So what does it need? Well, it needs the execution of the second person. It needs the energizing of the third person to bring the cosmos into being. And so he is arresting it before our eyes so that we may see God, all of him, as one and as the three coming together to bring about the creation of the universe. All right. But that idea of tohu and bohu is carried over into paganism as chaos, so that in almost every one of the creation accounts all over the world, at some level or another, the world is created out of chaos. Chaos is the original primordial state of all things. And it is the state into which everything will go as it winds down. It will go back into chaos again. So chaos, bringing order, the divine bringing of order out of chaos, in other words, chaos becomes the substance of everything. And the bringing of order out of chaos is the Greek idea of creation. Their idea of creation is not ex nihilo. It is the formation of order out of chaos. That's their view of creation. And it's most cultures' view of creation. So we have, for the most part, a unique idea of creation, that is creation ex nihilo, out of nothing. But most views of creation are an idea of bringing order out of chaos. And a lot of their eschatology has to do with whether or not everything is going to go back into chaos again. And we'll talk about that when we get into Zoroastrianism and so forth, and Gnosticism. The whole idea of fighting against the tendency of going into chaos. So man goes to war against chaos. Order is absolutely necessary in order to do that. And yet, isn't going against chaos, isn't that something that God does, so to speak? And so that's intolerable. Therefore, man hates order and seeks chaos. Part of it has to do with our psychological makeup as sinners. We love nebulosity. We like lack of clarity. The admix of good evil is not necessarily something that we want to sort out. All right? Ethics is not one of our favorite subjects. Because once good and evil become clear, we become responsible and it begins to bear upon our conscience. That's why man hates God's law. Because God's law is clear ethics. It divides good and evil. That's what the law of God does. The religions of man stay as far away from that as they possibly can. They don't want that kind of religion. What they want is balance. They want golden mean. They want some kind of harmonious synthesis between the extreme dualities. They want in some way to reconcile the differences, to break down the antithesis between good and evil, and to bring them closer together with one another, to redefine ethics on terms of other kinds of good and evil constructs that man brings up himself. To do that, he has to recreate the world, to recreate the world so that the principles of good and evil can be redefined along different lines. Man's good at doing that. He's such a natural endemic lawyer when it comes down to how he deals with ethics. You know, if you don't like your ethical system, then revise all of your history. That's what you do. Have you noticed that every revolutionary system has done that? As soon as revolution takes place, there's got to be a culture revolution come right after it, and immediately you begin to revise history. Revise history, then you can re-explain why it is we do the things we do. So so that your ethics switches over to the side of whatever ideology you have in your revolution. All right? Man's been doing that forever. So we kind of like to be in a fog bank, because in a fog bank we've got some squash room for compromise and for expediency and all that good stuff. Whereas if we weren't in the fog bank and everything was really clear to us, or we like to be in darkness. Darkness is another pagan atmosphere. He loves darkness, because it's okay if I can't see as long as nobody else can either. All right? Which is kind of socialism, really. The way for me to be equal is for everybody to be equal, the way I want to be equal. And whether it all falls out for them to be equal or not, doesn't matter to me as long as I am. Well, if it's dark, it's dark to everybody. If we're blind, we're all blind. And that's okay, you know. If we're all in the fog bank, then that's fine. And when somebody starts telling me I'm doing something wrong, I can say, you know, it's just not that clear, though, right? Have you ever had people do that after an argument takes place and they're just starting to feel the tinge of the ethic coming after them, of God's law coming after them? What do? They slip into nebulosity. Oh, you know, it's all subject to interpretation, right? You know, that's your interpretation. This is my interpretation. As if, you know, and think about it. If everybody's interpretation is equally valid, then what do we have? A fog bank. There is no clarity at all. None. Man loves that. He loves that environment. He likes to retreat into it. However, there's another side of him that is fighting against it. Because there's another side of him that wants to see and wants to know and wants to, you know, there is that longing inside of him to come out of the cave into the light of day. But yet his eyes are so accustomed to the darkness that he can hardly come out. And that's one of the tensions inside of man that controls his religion and his philosophy, is this tension between clarity and chaos. Chaos is very, very important in human thinking. And we have to take that into account when we begin to look at the formation of philosophy, which is to come.